Hello and welcome to the Pirate Party Australia webcast, dedicated to the discussion of freedom of information and culture, government transparency and civil liberties in the internet age. I'm Sam Kearns and this is episode number 13 on Tuesday, 10th of May, 2016.
Returned from visiting the Governor-General, as you've observed, and the Governor-General has accepted my advice to dissolve both Houses of Parliament, effective tomorrow morning, and call an election for both Houses, a double dissolution, on the 2nd of July.
And with that announcement from the Prime Minister just 2 days ago on Mother's Day, the Australian federal election was officially on, and the Pirate Party Australia webcast returned for another season. So the election announcement came hot on the heels of the 2016 budget from Scott Morrison on the previous Tuesday. This election announcement wasn't a surprise. Turnbull's been talking about it for a couple of months now. In fact, it surprised me when I heard that it wasn't already solid. Because I kept thinking, oh, I should find out, you know, exactly when that thing is on. And then I heard the official announcement, which was good to know, because I wasn't actually as uninformed as I thought. Anyway, Pirate Party Australia is not being caught flat-footed because we already had our pre-selection process underway with the pre-selection ballot for our Senate positions going up during the previous week. And in fact, the timing was great because the ballot ended at midnight on the Saturday night, and the votes were counted on Sunday, and that's when the election was announced. So at the same time as the election, we were able to announce our candidates, which I will now read to you. The Pirate Party Australia candidates for the Senate election. In Victoria, we have Lachlan Simpson and Richard Burley. In Queensland, we have Brandon Selleck, Isaac Pursehouse. And in New South Wales, we have Sam Kearns and Darren McIntosh. Wait, what? Yes, that's right. I am a Senate candidate for Pirate Party Australia in New South Wales. Which is part of the reason why the podcast is returning. Because it is kind of going to be part of my election campaign, part of putting myself out there so that people know who I am. And to help me in this endeavour, I actually have another of our Senate candidates, Brandon Selleck, who has agreed to come and help me with the podcast and is now going to be my new co-host. So welcome to the show, Brandon Selleck.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Awesome. Now, I've got to say, it is fantastic to finally have another person on the podcast who is actually going to help me out. You know, I made, you know, a dozen of these podcasts from about, you know, between a period of 2 to 3 years ago. And one of the reasons the podcasts, you know, were always kind of sporadic and never continued for very long is because they took me such a long time to put together. And, you know, I mean, back in the day, I always said, you know, look, there'd be more podcasts if I had help. And now I'm getting it. So thank you very much. And yeah, we've put paid to that because I only decided I was going to put this podcast out late on Sunday night, and it's now Tuesday night, and here we are doing it, which is yeah, an order of magnitude less preparation than I have done previously. So, so anyway, Brandon, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, like how did you discover the Pirate Party, and how did you get involved?
Oh, I got involved back in 2009 during the start of the Gamers for Croydon movement. and the Pirate Party that sprung out of that from the international pirate movement, as I recall. And so I jumped on pretty quickly. I was still a law student then when I started. And so I joined up. Not much happened there, unfortunately. And so we plodded along. And I think I came back to the party around 2012 and started being a bit more active and a bit more involved in regards to participating in events. And then in 2014, I became the state coordinator for Queensland, and I've been trying to run things in Queensland for the Pirate Party since then. And now that we've had a double dissolution election, I figured I'd better put my money where my mouth is and run as a candidate.
Fantastic. So 2012 is when I got involved. So, you know, we've been sort of, you know, parallel in the party over that time. I've been out of it for a little while at the moment, though. But tell me more about, you know, why you decided to run as a candidate.
I like a lot of people, I think, in the Pirate Party, I've become increasingly dissatisfied with the political process in this country. I've always been interested in politics. I was an Australian Democrat back when I was a teenager, and the Democrats obviously no longer exist. And so I went looking for a party that I thought would be a good fit. Now, basically, a lot of ex-Democrats either went to the Greens or they went to the Pirate Party, as far as I could tell. And I went with the Pirate Party.
Did they really? I had not known that input to Pirate Party from the Democrats.
Well, I think more went to the Greens, quite honestly. But there's as is my understanding, there are a few ex-Democrats in the Pirate Party. So, looking at the Pirate Party's policies and their platform, I felt more aligned with those policies than I did with the Greens, and so here I am. And I decided to put myself up for a Senate candidate spot because, as I said, I've been complaining about the political situation in this country quite loudly for the last couple of years. But I figured if I didn't put myself out there, I can really not say, well, other people should get out there as well. So I'm trying to lead by some sort of example here.
Yeah, I certainly understand that motivation.
Yeah, and yeah, I just want to be able to say something in regards to this campaign because in regards to this election period, because both of the major parties have shown in this government and the last Labor government that they just aren't getting it right. They're just too similar in regards to how they're handling things and also how they are badly managing things. And so we need to show. Well, I'd like to show that there are alternatives to the two-party system. One of them is the Pirate Party. We're not the only one out there, but of course they're the one I'm going to be pushing forward for obvious reasons. But to show the people that, yes, the two-party system isn't working anymore, there has to be alternatives, and also that the people are the ones who really should be dictating as to what governments are doing in regards to how they're handling things like asylum seeker policy and that sort of thing, which we'll be discussing later.
Yeah, well, for my own part, I really wanted to run in the election that we had in 2013, when the Pirate Party called for candidates, was it 2013 or was it 2014?
I think it was 2013.
Yeah, and but you know, my life was. I was not in a situation where I was really, you know, terribly organized or ready to do that. You know, I mean, full disclosure, I joined the Pirate Party because, I needed friends. I was in a situation of like extreme, like financial hardship and, you know, was working like crazy hours and, you know, I had a young family and, you know, for my own sort of mental health, I needed to find, you know, friends to have like outside of, you know, because I basically, you know, wasn't really socializing with anyone. And so I found the Pirate Party, which was fantastic. You know, I made a lot of friends. But then, you know, over the last few years, you know, the business failed, the marriage fell apart, you know, and I've had a lot of upheaval in my life. I've moved 6 times. So, you know, to put a bit of a background onto, you know, why the podcast has been sort of sporadic and not around much. This time around, you know, it's actually, you know, the timing has been great because, you know, over the last couple of years I've slowly sort of, you know, squared away, you know, many aspects of my life, you know, sort of regained my confidence, you know, put my financial situation back together. And I'm now in a position where, you know, I've learned so much from my experience. You know, I have, you know, a lot of strong opinions about the way our society is organized because of, you know, the pressures that I've been under. Those pressures, you know, even though, you know, I've been through sort of a lot of traumatic times, you know, hardship builds character. And
that it does.
And, you know, it really opens your eyes to the, you know, the struggles of people who are less fortunate. And so, you know, this time when the, you know, when the call went out for candidates, I was like, you know what, I'm in a good position now. You know, I can do this and I think I could do it, you know, even better than, you know, 3 years ago. And once I decided that, I knew immediately, well, if I'm doing this, I'm doing the podcast again, because, you know, the podcast was a fantastic vehicle for the party, you know, a great way to, you know, put myself out there. And also it's a really good, you know, just quietly, it's a fantastic sort of training ground for, you know, building up your ability to speak. I mean, you know, really right here, you know, you and I are both getting, you know, in a very safe little space, you know, a bit of training on how to actually, you know, talk to the public and the media, even though it's only ourselves. this is, you know, I think it's a great training ground for public speaking. So,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, to go to the broader issues as well, you know, I mean, things like asylum seekers, policy of, you know, successive governments, you know, fiscal policies, but even broader, you know, the sort of overall paradigm that Australia has been sort of stuck in for the last 25 years has been, you know, extremely disappointing to me. You know, the increase of sort of, you know, racist elements in our society. I mean, I grew up in the 80s believing that, you know, that we had learned our lessons from World War II about, you know, the dangers of you know, racism, and, you know, the dangers of you know, demonizing, you know, other nationalities, and also that we'd learned our lesson about, you know, the dangers of, like, disregarding the environment. I feel like I grew up with this message that these were learned lessons. I watched in horror over the 90s as all of these things sort of went backwards. And since 2000, you know.
No, I have to.
Sorry, keep interrupting you.
No, it's all right. I've been phasing it out now. Just jump in. No, I have to agree with you in regards to that. I grew up in the 80s as well in Sydney. And again, I thought a lot of these things were things of the past. But in recent years, I mean, going far back as the 90s, but it seems more so in recent years, it looks like all of this stuff hasn't gone away. It's just been bubbling underneath, and now we've kicked the rock over, and we've found this ugly thing underneath, and we can't just put the rock back. We're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I feel like it's not even just a matter of it was always there and we uncovered it. I think, you know, the leadership of the country has a lot to answer for in terms of fermenting this for their own sort of political expediency.
And, yes.
Which is awful, you know, that it should come from that avenue. And so, you know, all of these things go together to just make me think, you know, I have to do something, you know. The Mark Twain, I think it's Mark Twain, pretty much any cool quote that's old, you can pretty much say it was Mark Twain and people will believe you. In fact, it might even have been like Socrates or someone like that. This is terrible. I should be looking up my quotes before I say them. But it's a good one nonetheless, which is that those who ignore politics are doomed to be ruled by their inferiors, I think is, you know, it sort of rings loudly in my ears whenever I think of these issues. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to engage because it's just too, you know, gross and shameful. But, you know, you just can't not. You know, and I think once you have once you have children, like, your perspective sort of fundamentally shifts on your responsibility in these things. So anyway, that's kind of rolls together, you know, the things that I wanted to say about why I've become a candidate and also where I've been for the last 2 years since the last podcast episode. Well, I think that wraps us up for sort of reintros and the new season. I'll just quickly say that this, you know, this season of the podcast, I'm intending to run it at least fortnightly until the election is over. And then we'll see what happens after that. If we've managed to get this thing streamlined enough that it's not like devouring all of my spare time every week, then I'm hoping we can continue on a more regular basis. Because I got to say, you know, like as I mentioned earlier, producing the podcast, you know, it used to take me like anything from like 10 to 20 hours of pre-production, which is pretty much all of your spare time. I mean, especially back then when I was also running a business that wasn't doing very well and had young children and, you know, a marriage that wasn't doing very well. And I lived on the Central Coast and worked in Sydney. So you can imagine, like, what my typical week looked like.
The commute alone, God.
And then on top of that, I'm trying to put together the podcast. It was just insanity. So, yes, new season for this election season. And speaking of election season and what's happening in Australian politics, we've got two issues we're going to cover in this podcast, our two like main issues. One of them is asylum seekers, which we're going to talk about later because I think we both agree it is, you know, one of the major issues in national politics today, and I'm sure it's going to come up plenty over the course of this election campaign. But first, we're going to discuss the budget
that
has just come out. And your first work assignment as my co-host was to research this one. So over to you, Brandon. What have you got for us for Budget 2016?
Okay. From the outset, I'm not a financial expert, so I've been looking to my betters in the financial field to try and break the budget down and get an understanding of what within it works and what doesn't. Now, most of the analysis here is based on the work of the Pirate Party Australia Treasurer, Mark Gibbons, because he provided a breakdown in our discussion forums online. So a cursory glance shows that this budget is nowhere near as bad as the document the Abbott government produced 2 years ago. Now, that being said, it's got some issues. Now, firstly, there are surplus predictions. Does it seem like we're still living in the shadow of the Howard years and their obsession with surplus? Anyway, the last six of these predictions on the country's return to surplus have been missed, and it appears that this one will miss it as well. These predictions are based on the faulty assumption that the economy will return to growing like it did in the commodity boom, and really only a serious economic reform can make that happen at this point.
Now, flowing from there, there are company tax cuts in this budget. Now, this is something in principle the Pirate Party gets behind, and the bulk of available evidence and expert opinion supports it. But despite what some economists will tell you, economics is not like is not a science in that in what we consider a science. And so there are certainly respectable and well-founded objections to such a move. Now, from the Pirate Party's perspective, now this is a preferred stance to cut company tax, but we would also be looking at removing fund-shifting loopholes and concessions on fossil fuels and the like. Now, continuing in that vein, there are removals of tax loopholes in this budget. Now, we would consider that a good thing, but we'll have to see if it yields the projected $3 billion that's being suggested here. Though, frankly, it does seem odd that all this money was just sitting on the table, so to speak, and successive governments have just chosen not to take it.
I have to admit, I'll believe that when I see it. You know, call me skeptical, but, you know, and maybe that skepticism is unfounded. And how we'll know is that all the those companies will be absolutely crying about it. But anyway, moving on.
Looking next, there is the National Innovation and Science Agenda. Now, again, the Pirate Party, we consider this a good thing, and it's seemingly a far cry from the previous budgets. In Australia, we've got a real problem with commercialization of research. And not being able to do that denies an important well of funding to scientific work in this country. Now, attempting to fix that and also trying to improve incentives for small and new businesses is a good start. Now, the Pirate Party, we'd like to see more funding for basic research as well, and maybe that'll happen. But this policy is certainly a break from the Abbott years, and that is definitely an improvement. Okay, moving on. Defence spending. Looking at this budget, it seems a little excessive. Now, the goal of defence funding at 2% of GDP is spurious, apparently. Spending $50 billion on custom-made orphan boats. By orphan, had to look this up in regards to talking about military hardware. An orphan project, if I'm recalling right, means it's no direct succession. There's no direct line of succession in regards to previous technology.
Well, I did wonder about that when you said that. I was wondering if this was just like a pejorative statement, but it does actually have a meaning that they're talking. So there's no direct successor to these. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the Collins class project, as I understand it, had similar problems. And I was talking with some old army buddies of mine, that's to say old friends of mine who were in the army. I am not ex-military.
Okay.
that clarification sometimes gets lost. Talking to them in regards to the white paper that was published. That was behind this defence spending. Now, I've only had a cursory glance at this white paper. I need to really get into it, but it. According to my my friends in the military, they see it was a good idea from that perspective. But from our perspective, so spending $50 billion on custom-made orphan boats that won't be completed until 2060 is not a great idea. Technology, as we all know, moves too quickly, and the later boats will be obsolete before they're even built.
2060?
Yeah, apparently, according to this document, which I was surprised at that projection. I mean, it's 12 subs, as we know. And the fact that it'll take that long to build them all is strange to me, considering what we hear of some shipyards producing boats. But then again, submarine technology, I'm certainly no expert there, so this is maybe a standard timeline. I have no idea, but it seems like this doesn't seem to take into account the obsolescence that's going to occur at the end of the sub's lifetime.
Yeah.
The suggestion we've got from Mark is buying subs off the shelf at half the price and dispensing with... also dispensing with the Joint Strike Force Fighter, which is another military black hole project. Canada, when Justin Trudeau became Prime Minister of Canada, one of the first things he did was cut Canada's participation in the Joint Strike Force Fighter funding. So that is something Australia could look at as well.
Yeah.
Shifting these savings to foreign aid and seeking to build security by reducing poverty in our region would be better spent. In later podcasts, I would like to talk about how Australia has been handling diplomatic relations and foreign aid with our neighbours, but that would be a discussion for another time.
Yeah. Definitely something that we could talk about. That would be great.
Now, moving on to domestic matters, there is an internship scheme
Now, this is an improvement from the Abbott era. Simply cutting off benefits to the young was really what was the sticking point in that budget 2 years ago. If you'll recall, there was the idea of making students and people on youth benefits wait 6 months before their payments were brought in. Now, this has been thrown out in regards to this PATH scheme. Mm-hmm. Now, this appears to be done with good intentions and a lot of expert review. Mark's analysis was it may work, but watch out that it's not abused or turned to an alternative to full-paid jobs. Now, he reckons it deserves a chance. Now, on this one, because I do have a bit of experience here, I sat because I do a bit of employment law and my work as a community lawyer. So I sat down with a couple of employment law colleagues and we looked at how you could improve just this particular aspect of the budget.
Yep.
Now, one thing we looked at, so now internships can't be offered without a guaranteed specific permanent paid position at the end of it if the internship is successful. That means there's no floating interns means they're not added as a new lowest level to the workforce and they're being explicitly trained.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you'd want to look at bringing special amendments into the Fair Work Act 2009 and federal and state anti-discrimination laws would have to protect those interns. Moving on from there, you'd want to gain unfair dismissal protection as soon as the internship is completed. Normally, that comes in after 6 months.
Right, yep.
But you'd want the internship to be what we would call the probation period.
Yep.
And also along there, you'd want to gain general protections under the Fair Work Act. So that includes age and, again, anti-discrimination rights when the internship begins. So also moving on from there, internships like apprenticeships, they'd require internal records of the training and the competency received to be verified by both parties. In this case, the trainer, the employer, and the employee.
Mm.
Now, those records can be produced to the intern on request after the internship, either as evidence of wrongdoing or to demonstrate there are certified competencies to future employers, even if the internship is rejected. So, essentially, a reference in that regard.
Yeah.
Now, the further suggestions that we discussed now, more than two successive interns not making the cuts in regards to the employer would result in an investigation by the Department of Employment. In the event of wrongdoing, employers can be given corrective action, fined, or banned from the program. This would take into account the idea that people would be certain employers would be using these PATH interns as disposable labour.
Yeah.
Keep them on the low income for the 3 months, then kick them to the curb. And on the inverse of that, in the event that more than two successive interns don't make the cut for the job, any job placement officer who facilitated the internship will also face investigative review. Now, if there's found to be wrongdoing or negligence by the job placement officer, they would face censure. This is to remove the potential of abuse or the lack of caring or foresight by people who facilitate job placement officers. There is a concern that they're not caring who they put in. They're just putting anyone in, even if they might not be a good fit for that job. So that idea would eliminate that. And finally, a certain number of rejected interns across a six-month period also trigger review of the job placement officer. So, yeah, conceptually it might work, but it needs some improvements. Maybe we should give it a chance. But there are some valid fears in regards to how this program would play out that the budget and the policies seem silent on.
Well, certainly. I mean, those protections do sound better than, you know, things that I hear about internships from the United States.
Oh, yeah.
So,
agree. Moving towards an... Yeah.
Mm. Sorry, go on.
No, go on.
I was just going to say I agree that it's, you know, worth giving it a chance.
Mm. Yeah, moving towards a more American system in regards to job placement and also healthcare is not something we want to do. But no. Again, probably a conversation for another time. Mm. Okay, now grandfathering the carbon tax compensation. There were some mixed feelings on this one. Now, finding savings to fund the National Disability Insurance Scheme properly, definitely a good idea. We're certainly on board with that. But New Start, which was cited in particular here by Mark, is too low, and this will make matters worse. This could create poverty traps in that people who leave welfare and then have to go back on welfare will get less than before, so they may choose to stay on welfare perpetually. This measure would probably not pass in the current Senate, as it stands now with the crossbench. Superannuation. I was actually hoping to get some more information on superannuation. One of my oldest friends is a superannuation expert, but unfortunately he has not come through on me, so we'll just go with Mark's analysis. Now, they're curbing high income concessions and reducing super tax for low earners.
Now, that's progressive and seems like a reasonable way to meet objectives of turning super into a pure retirement funding scheme as opposed to a tax lurk or a benefit for the wealthy as superannuation has been accused of.
Yeah, I've also been hearing about how these benefits are going to be good for women or people who've had a break from work. But it mostly seems to be around better tax concessions for people who are making additional contributions in the lower income brackets.
Well, again, superannuation, we want this government and from previous governments and successive governments will want retirees to be as self-funding as possible.
Yep.
So bringing in these sort of changes would be a good idea. Whether they'll work, you would have to ask a superannuation expert. Okay, now in regards to infrastructure funding, there's extension to rail projects, not just roads. Again, this is a good thing and another break from the Abbott government prior to this one. I mean, infrastructure spending in this country has been poor for a while, and we can jump onto the NBN at any point from that discussion, but we won't do it today.
Yeah, and also, rail is a bit of a sore point where I live in Newcastle. They just truncated the line into town.
They did.
To much wailing and gnashing of teeth. And the replacement light rail has been delayed and delayed. I just keep waiting for them just to announce that it's not going to happen. Because that would just be icing on the cake. But anyway, maybe we'll actually see it now if there's more funding for rail projects. But
well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
And penultimately, there has been some reversing of cuts to schools and hospitals. The Pirate Party, of course, welcomes that, but whether it's enough is another matter. And finally, getting into the negative gearing argument, which will probably dominate a lot of this election lead up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's the huge gap in... The huge gap, housing speculators will still get tax benefits and use of negative gearing. Now, no other country favours housing speculation this way. Speculation is not an investment, and its losses shouldn't be needed to be offset by taxpayers. We really need to stop sacrificing our labour and our productive economy and our savings at the altar of the housing market. We'll only ever have the same amount of land, no matter how much we spend on it. Now, we want the economy to do better. We should be directing our funds to productive things which we don't already own. Mark's final note on this was he would also like to see a proper fibre to the premises NBN. That would create an asset which can be sold to recover much of the funds. Whatever costs remain will be more than met by the benefits. And that ties in with the infrastructure planning. I'm surprised there's no tie in with that. I did see an article... amongst this discussion, it said that the NBN Corporation was actually running out of money. We might want to put a link to that article with the podcast.
Okay, sure.
As something to discuss.
Yeah, but both of these issues are very dear to my heart. Housing affordability and, the speculative nature of the Australian housing market.
Let me pick up that thread. I mean, housing affordability has been a problem since the Rudd government. I keep wanting to say administration. That's an American term. No, we have governments here, not administrations. Housing affordability has been a problem since the Rudd government. It's continuing to this point. I mean, it makes sense, as much as I disagree with the policy, it makes sense for the coalition government to continue on with a negative gearing mindset simply because it's what a lot of their constituents want. Another article, which I'll try and put a link to, for this podcast, shows which electorates have the highest usage of negative gearing. And unsurprisingly, the biggest electorate would be Malcolm Turnbull's.
Yeah. Well, it's a hole they've dug for themselves, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Though NBN, why they don't support the NBN, I've got no idea.
All the talk about, this budget, leading us into the new economy. We don't just need a budget for that.
We need infrastructure, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for that budget wrap. That was very comprehensive. but yeah, times the podcast is getting longer and longer, and we need to move on to our next topic of discussion.
Absolutely.
And this one is we're going to talk a little bit about asylum seekers. Now, Pirate Party Australia recently released a statement on the website after two asylum seekers on Nauru committed acts of self-immolation less than a week after the Supreme Court of Papua New Guinea held that Manus Island Detention Centre is unconstitutional. Now, you know, our PR was because, you know, in response to the government's, you know, incredible statement that, you know, suggesting that these self-harm incidents were politically motivated and the asylum seekers were not distressed. You know, and it begars belief how, you know, if you're not actually distressed, but you want to make a, you know, you kind of want to have a jab, you want to make a statement, I know I'll burn myself. Like, like, yeah. In what world is that like a thought process that you could possibly believe occurred? Because, you know, self-immolation, you know, those people would have to have believed that they were going to die, you know, or be, and or, you know,
yeah,
have be horribly disfigured and have no, you know, no, like, you know, hugely reduced quality of life after that act.
Mm.
That is not something that you do, you know, to make, you know, just to make some statement that's politically motivated.
Yeah, and just tying into that, it was offensive that there were statements that suggesting that it was advocates who were putting the asylum seekers up to that behaviour.
Yeah. You know, even if there were people telling them that they deserved better, which of course they do, and, you know, you're not going to get to that level of, you know, extreme action unless you are already under, you know, extreme duress. Like, I just, you know, it's incredible. I can't understand how they can think that, you know. But of course, it's not about what they think, it's about what they want to spin.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess at this point it doesn't matter what the you know, what the asylum seekers did, you know, they would find a way to, you know, negatively spin their actions because they just cannot, you know, they just can't allow, you know, the scheme to sort of be viewed negatively, regardless of the cost. And, you know, and that's, you know, and what is that cost? You know, I mean, the cost to, like, our national psyche of, you know, what's being done in our name. You know, the Australian opinion on this is just, you know, been going downhill for a very long time. You know, again, just like the housing affordability, one wonders how long it can, you know, continue down this road.
Well, the fact that we're still talking about this two elections later when we were talking about it back then is just boggles me. The fact that this is still an issue, that this is still ongoing, that nothing has been done, and it's gotten worse.
Yeah, it's well, yeah, again, it's a hole that they've dug, you know, and now that they've set the precedent of, you know, having this attitude, it's almost like they're committing a sunk cost fallacy, you know, on their own position, you know, that they can't sort of reverse out of it now, which is crazy. I mean, you know, I mean, Australia, you know, the modern history of Australia is, you know, built entirely on immigration. You know, I mean, each successive wave of migration, you know, has always been accompanied by, you know, a fear of culture change that's always turned out to be unfounded. You know, I mean, there was fear of Chinese migrants in the Gold Rush era, you know, fear of European nationalities from, you know, the Axis powers after the post-war era.
Which is where my family's from. My family came over with the first wave of migrants after the Second World War. I'm second generation Australian from that regard.
Right, and where were they from?
If I might ask. All over Germany, Russia, the Czech Republic, and Yugoslavia.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, there would have been fear about that sort of thing, especially with the Red Scare.
Oh, absolutely.
And those sorts of things going on. And then, you know, fear of Southeast Asian people in the late 20th century after the Vietnam War era. Yeah, and in every case in history, you know, these waves of migrants have ended up becoming a part of this, you know, of the fabric of Australian society after a relatively short adjustment period on the scale of, you know, when you think about it on the scale of nation building. You know, I mean, it's not the West Bank here.
No.
You know, after, you know, waves and waves and waves of migrations from, you know, so many different corners of the world, you know, and I'm talking about Chinese, Italian, Greek, you know, Lebanese, German, Vietnamese. I mean, all of the, I remember being young and these people, you know, like there was, you know, negative sentiment around them. And yet they are all, you know, integrated, you know, parts of Australian society now, you know. You know, and they were all in the past feared as like cultural outsiders, you know, cultural boogeyman that sort of melted to nothing as soon as we got bored with old news, you know, and stopped stuffing the boogeyman with straw. You know, indeed, you know, Chinese migrants in the Gold Rush era is what caused like the White Australia policy to be implemented in the first place. Because they were afraid of, you know, Australian culture being sort of swamped by Asians, you know. And now we see, you know, in like if you go to, you know, Sydney CBD now, it has a very high population of Asian people, you know, precisely what the White Australia policy was designed to prevent. And yet Sydney is still as Australian as ever and culturally much richer for it. You know, and so fast forward to today, and the fear is now of people from Middle Eastern nations. And somehow we managed to treat this as some kind of unusual situation we've never seen before. You know, oh my God, what's going to happen to Australian culture if we let these people in? You know, all this, you know, fear of halal and mosques and this sort of thing. And, you know, it's like, have we learned nothing? You know, do we not know our own past? You know, it's insane. And, you know, and so, but then, you know, people also object to, you know, well, what's it going to cost? You know, if we allow these boat people to come, you know, what about the bad eggs? You know, 9/11 happened, terrorism is real, you know, so are Islamic extremists, you know, we're just going to let them in. But the number of refugees who've actually committed terrorist attacks is so tiny. Like they are, you know, or have been connected in any way with terrorism at all. It's so tiny, they're no greater risk than any other segment of the Australian population.
Absolutely.
You know, and the greatest terrorist act in Australia, you know, was still committed by, you know, a white Australian.
Mm. And I'll just jump in there again, because again, this has been a problem for 70 years. My grandparents told me stories that yes, there were bad people amongst the migrant boats that they were on. That's always been the case. There's always going to be some bad eggs in there, but look, Australian society 70 years later is still standing despite any of those bad influences that might have come over.
Yeah, it's such a bad apples argument.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the majority prevails, and the majority of people you know, are coming for, you know, well-meaning reasons. You know, and, you know, people complain about, you know, what's it going to cost us too, but, you know, do people understand that detaining refugees offshore actually costs us between $200,000 to $450,000 per person per year? I mean, there's no way we spend that much on welfare recipients. even assuming that they all became welfare recipients, it would still be a saving. You know, if you want to if you want to play the purely, you know, economic card. But you know, the thing that frustrates me most about all of this, and, you know, especially those kind of economic arguments, is that we're pretending like, you know, we're acting as though these people are just a massive dead loss liability. And when, you know, our past shows us that when, you know, when people have migrated to Australia, even people from, you know, who've come with nothing because, you know, they were like post-war refugees, you know, convicts, dare I say, that those people have, you know, made a new life in Australia and, you know, have become like, you know, integral, you know, to the building of the nation. And by looking at these people as a pure liability, we're saying that we can never make anything worthwhile of their coming here. And I think, what does that really say about us and our ability to, you know, inspire and lead Australians to, you know, a more prosperous life? You know, I mean, what think about it the other way. What kind of Australia could we build if we knew that we could take any and all peoples and help them to be the greatest that they can be? You know, like, if we could do that, then we'd be like, you know, then every person who wanted to come is an investment, not a liability. You know, if we could take these people and say, look, you know, we can give you education, we can give you leadership, we can help you to, you know, realize your fullest potential, and then you will be an asset to Australia. You know, why wouldn't you, you know, take as many people as you could if that was a possibility, you know? And by saying that well, that's not going to happen, we can't do that, what does that say about the leadership in Australia? What does that say about our ability to actually make something of ourselves, let alone of someone else? You know, I mean, Australians worry about the loyalty of outsiders who come to this land, you know, and rightly so, because, you know, loyalty is something that is inspired by leadership or not, you know, and leadership that empowers and encourages people by recognizing and utilizing their unique talents and strengths and then binding them together, you know, with a shared noble purpose, you know, this is what inspires loyalty. You know, when was the last time you were inspired to loyalty by the leadership of this country?
Ooh. Right?
You know, looking back at the last 15 years, you know, what loyalty have we inspired in, you know, refugees and migrants? You know, what loyalty do we inspire in our own people? You know, and then people have the temerity to demand it, to say, you know, well, what if they're not loyal? Like, as if it's just some automatic right?
Like, yes.
You know, when you turn it on its head like that, and, you know, it really sort of shines a light on what's missing.
And the policies they stand are doing the exact opposite to do that. It is going back to the metaphor of digging the hole. We are causing problems for ourselves down the line.
Yeah.
In regards to how we are treating these people in these offshore detention centres.
Yeah.
There's going to be problems down the line of how we've handled this situation, certainly, and we're going to have to be prepared to face that.
Yeah, the legacy of it is going to be long and problematic.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, you know, which is another reason why they can't just about face on it.
No.
Oh, what a mess.
And really, what we should be saying to people is you should not be voting for any party who doesn't have a policy in regards to trying to turn this around, or any party that would want to continue the status quo on this matter should not get your vote.
Yeah.
Absolutely. This is no longer a political issue. This is a moral issue.
Yes. Well, I think we're going to have to put that down at this point because the podcast has gone plenty long. I like long podcasts, but other people don't. I don't know what's wrong with them. But because I can never get enough of interesting talk. And this is interesting talk. But so just to round things off, I'm going to announce that on Saturday, I'm completely disorganized right about now because I'm just checking my calendar. But on Saturday the 28th of May, there is a pirate meetup in Sydney, the usual one at Paragon. So I'm going to try and make it. And do you know of do you have anything coming up in Queensland that you can announce?
Yes, we're looking at having a mini meetup on the, I think it is the 15th. Yeah, that's this coming Sunday, the 15th. Okay. Not sure where the location will be. Probably be the Ship Inn again at South Bank in Brisbane, around midday or so. Well, actually, no, probably be a bit later at this point. But I'll be putting that on the calendar officially in the next couple of days.
And that's on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, as always, we finish the show with a quote. And just to finish off this very long show, I have a very long quote. And this one comes from Prime Minister Robert Menzies' speech for the opening of World Refugee Year in Australia. And the juxtaposition with current attitudes towards refugees could not be more stark, which is why I chose this quote to read. And to do it proper justice, I'm going to read the entire speech. It's not that long. And on the 27th of September, 1959, in a broadcast address, the founder of the Liberal Party and then Prime Minister of Australia said, 1959 has been named World Refugee Year by the United Nations. In the resolution carried in November of last year, it was decided to focus interest in the refugee problem and to encourage additional financial contributions from governments, voluntary agencies, and the general public. An appeal was made to all member states to promote World Refugee Year. This humane resolution was carried against the votes of the Soviet bloc. Australia has fully accepted and is participating in it. Since the war, the problem of refugee has been both melancholy and acute. There are many thousands of refugees in Europe, and these are added to every day. In the Middle East, there are a million Arab refugees. From China have come thousands of refugees of European origin. In Hong Kong, there are at least a million Chinese refugees. We, in Australia, have in earlier years brought over 200,000 refugees to our shores. Our country is, on a population basis, the leading country of refugee settlement. Living under good conditions and with complete freedom, we might have had little reason to understand the heartbreaking experience which has been undergone by so many people driven from their homes and occupations into strange countries, there to eke out a miserable and precarious living in completely unaccustomed circumstances. The refugee problem is, in that sense, one of social and economic resettlement. In another sense, it is a moral problem. It is to Australia's credit that she has, in fact, understood such matters very well. In one sense, this, of course, is a problem for governments. In another, a problem for the churches. But in the major sense, it is a problem for private citizens who desire to make some humane contribution to its solution. The Commonwealth Government gives a lead. We have promised a cash contribution of £50,000 and also that public donations to this fund will be allowable deductions for income tax purpose. The matter is non-party. The Right Honourable Leader of the Opposition is supporting it. But bearing in mind the splendid tradition of generous giving in Australia for good causes, I have no doubt that the public response will be immediate and great. It has not been easy for organized world opinion in the United Nations or elsewhere to act directly in respect of some of the dreadful events which have driven so many people from their own homes and their own fatherland. But at least we can, in the most practical fashion, show our sympathy for those less fortunate than ourselves who have been the innocent victims of conflicts and upheavals of which in our own land we have been happy enough to know nothing. It is a good thing that Australia should have earned a reputation for a sensitive understanding of the problems of people in other lands, that we should not come to be regarded as people who are detached from the miseries of the world. I know that we will not come to be so regarded, for I believe that there are no people anywhere with warmer hearts and more generous impulses. This appeal, therefore, is at one and the same time a challenge and an opportunity. I am confident that we shall make a contribution which will serve as one more proof of our instinctive national and individual understanding and generosity. Pirate Party Australia webcast was written and recorded by Sam Kearns and Brandon Selleck, with all music and audio production by Sam Kearns. The show is made for Pirate Party Australia and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 Unported license. Thanks for listening.